I welcome you to worship this morning and to the conclusion of the E.Y. Mullins Week of Preaching at Southern Seminary for 1992. We're delighted that so many of you have joined us as guests for the week, especially conferees who've come to the annual conference. It's been a delight to have you, and we hope that you already have marked your calendars for next year. It's always good to have you back on the campus. This has been an unusually effective week for us. I know a few lecturers during the Mullins series who have so inspired us and challenged us to become more effective in our own proclamation of the gospel. It would be redundant for me to introduce our speaker. He's been well introduced prior to this time. I do, however, want to express our profound gratitude to you, Dr. Lowry, for your contribution to us, not only as a lecturer, but as an exemplar preacher, as a colleague in Christ, as you've been with us for the week. We thank you for your creative leadership in preaching, which signals for us a revival of the emphasis on preaching throughout the church in these two decades or more now behind us and will continue into the future. I hope that you will recognize our sincerity today in thanking you for your creative gifts and for what you've meant to us. And I would like for you, if you would, to come and let me share with you a small item of recollection as you look back on us in the future. That's a reproduction of the seminary seal, and we'd like for you to take that with you.
Well, thank you very much. Fine. How gracious. Yes. It's been so wonderful to be here.
It's been nice to have you.
Before I read the text for this morning, there are several things I want to say of appreciation. The honor of being asked to come here to be the Mullins lecturer, the privilege of being here, the joy of this week. I am grateful to everybody for the graciousness of my stay here. And this worship service, the music, the choir, it's just phenomenal. I mean, when the choir concluded, I said to myself, what am I doing here? I mean, it's time for the benediction. And the way you sing the hymns, you sound like Methodists. I mean, Charles Wesley would be proud. And the organist's work at that wonderful organ, it just takes your breath away. It has been wonderful to be here. I turn to the text, which is Mark, the 5th chapter, beginning with the first verse. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately a man out of the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. He lived among the tombs, and no one could restrain him anymore, even with a chain. For he'd often been restrained with shackles and chains, but the chains he wrenched apart and the shackles he broke in pieces. And no one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always howling and bruising himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and bowed down before him, and he shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you have to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For he had said to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" And he replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." He begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now, there on the hillside, a great herd of swine was feeding. And the unclean spirits begged him, "Send us into the swine, let us enter them." So he gave them permission, and the unclean spirits came out, entered the swine, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and were drowned in the sea. The herdsmen ran off and told it in the city and in the country. People came to see what it was that had happened. They came to Jesus and saw the demoniac sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, the very man who had had the legion. And they were afraid. Those who had seen what had happened to the demoniac and to the swine reported it. Then they began to beg Jesus to leave their neighborhood. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed by demons begged him that he might go with him. But Jesus refused and said, "Go home to your friends. Tell them how much the Lord has done for you and what mercy he has shown you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone was amazed. This is the word of the Lord. It was just an ordinary little Gentile village, indistinguishable, no doubt, from any of a number of Gentile villages located along the edge of the lake, except at least for one thing. If you happened to spend the night there, it's just quite possible that you would miss some sleep sometime during the night. You would be trying to get some rest, and all of a sudden you would hear these awful howls and groans and screams, half human, half animalish. You would wonder what on earth is going on out there and try to go back to sleep. Perhaps the next morning somebody would explain it to you and would say, "Well, you see, there's this crazy man here. I mean, he's possessed. He's got demons inside him. I mean, he's crazy and he howls. In fact, sometimes you can get a glimpse at him and sometimes his legs are bloody because he runs up against the rough edges of the rocks and bruises himself. I mean, he's a mess. He isn't just crazy. He's also strong. I mean, we've tried to shackle him up. We've tried to restrain him, but he just breaks loose. I mean, it's something. He's crazy and he's strong. But they say, we have kind of an agreement, him and the community. That is, we don't want him around town. We don't want him moving around where we move around. So he lives out in the graveyard, out among the tombs. That's where he stays, except when he's running up and down some mountain close by. That's where he stays. Yes, the man was not fit to live among the living. So they had him living among the dead. Before we get too critical of the way that community handles its social problems, we need to remember that, you know, that they probably didn't have a mental health center available close by. No psychiatrists. I bet they didn't even have a United Way. So we can't be too critical of the way they were handling their problems. I mean, they had found a way to live with things, and apparently so had he. Into this scene comes Jesus in a little boat. He and perhaps a couple of friends get out of the boat, and all of a sudden, this crazy man, this demon-possessed man, runs up and falls at his feet. One translation has it, he worships him, and he looks up and says in a very loud voice, "Jesus, Son of the Most High God, I adjure you by God, do not torment me." Now, that's peculiar in a number of ways. First of all, how did he know Jesus' name anyway? I mean, had he been closer into town than they knew and had overheard some conversation about the arrival of Jesus? Well, we don't even know that the people in town knew that Jesus was coming. I mean, and this was a Gentile village.
How did, somehow he knew Jesus' name. But then, to fall down and worship Jesus and then say, "Do not torment me." I mean, what's he doing there? If he doesn't want Jesus to torment him, why did he come out of the tombs to greet him to begin with? I mean, make up your mind. This, I think, is another case of the mysterium tremendum. He's attracted, drawn to Jesus, immediately falls down in worship, and is also repulsed because, oh, you understand, he wants to be well, but he doesn't want to be tormented. And sometimes they go together. You say, well, of course, what do you expect? I mean, the man is crazy. Well, you can call it crazy if you'd like. I call it familiar. Very familiar. That is, I remember one time, quite a number of years ago, I had a really bad cold, horrible chest cold. I couldn't get to, well, you understand, my doctor knows me pretty well. And, for all patients, I mean, he hates to give medicine. He just says, go to bed for 24 hours. If you're still feeling bad, then call me. So I learned when I had a bad cold, I just went to bed. And generally after 24 hours, I got up and around. But this time after 24 hours, I was worse than I had been when I went to bed. Well, I knew there was no option but to call the doctor, so I called Dr. Bennett. Set an appointment and arrived at the office. Well, you know, when you go to my doctor's office, it is kind of an act of worship. Do you know what I mean? I mean, he's not the great physician, but he ain't bad. But you step into the room, somebody looks out a window and says, "Please be seated." That's the call to worship. And you sit down and wait a while, those are called moments of meditation. Pretty soon you're ushered up into a room, into solitary confinement for another half hour. Finally you get the word. And as you go past the desk on the way out, you present your tithes and your offerings. Yes, it is kind of an act of worship, but this time when I was ushered in, I was not ushered into one of those little cubicles. I was ushered into Dr. Bennett's office. I thought that a bit peculiar. He finally showed up, and he said, "Gene, I can't do you any good." I said, "Well, Dale, I was hoping you might. That's why I came. I got this horrible cold. I mean, please help me." He said, "I can't do any help for you." He says, "You see, I know too much about you. I know your diet. I know that over half of everything you ingest has to do with Hydrox cookies and Pepsi Cola. I brought some here this week." he said, "Hydrox and Pepsi, that's it. That's most all of what you eat and drink." He said, "Don't you know you got a virus? And don't you know those viruses love sugar as much as you love sugar? I want to tell you, they just feast on it. As long as your diet is that way, there's no way I can get you well." He said, "So we're going to put an end to this." He said, "From now on, it's Diet Cola for you." You know what I said to Dr. Bennett? I'll paraphrase it quickly. What I said to Dr. Bennett was, "Do not torment me." I mean, you understand, I wanted to be well, but. Jesus turned to the man and said, "What is your name?" His answer is classic. He said, "My name is Legion, for we are many." Legion. You know what a legion is, a particular sized group of the Roman army numbering 6,000 soldiers. Do you hear what he was saying? "My name is Legion." He is saying, "I feel like I have an army inside my gut. And they may not all be marching the same direction. Maybe this way and then this way and then every which way." He says, "I've got an army inside of me, and I think I'm losing the war. I'm My name is Legion. For we are many. I think I understand. My name, he said, is Legion. Well, about this time, Jesus begins talking to the demons. And I suspect you might suspect that as a United Methodist, I do have a little trouble with portions of this passage. I mean, demons? I mean, you do understand, don't you, that, for example, I do not believe in the devil. And furthermore, I wish he would leave me alone. I mean, demons? I mean, they believe in demons? Jesus is going to talk to the demons? Now, isn't that quaint? Well, maybe it's not so strange as we might think. Because, you see, we believe in viruses. Have you ever seen one? Huh? What is a virus anyway? Is it animal, mineral, or vegetable? No, nobody really knows. I mean, if you got one today and you stepped on the scale, would you weigh more? I mean, we really don't know what a virus is. All we know is it gets a hold of us and it is in control. I mean, someday they'll look back on our day and they'll say, you know, the folks in the late 20th century, they thought they were so advanced technologically, they thought they were really uptown, you know. But you know, they believed in viruses. Isn't that quaint? We believe in viruses. They believed in demons. That is to say, something got hold of them and they were no longer in control. One might say possessed. Yes, indeed. They did. Jesus gets to talking to the demons. And they say, you know, we like pork. Yes, we like pork. And about this time, the demoniac is a little concerned because he wants to keep the Hydrox cookies close by. And he says, oh, don't send them too far. Don't send them too far. Just a bit away. You know what I mean? And Jesus said to the demons, you like pork, you get pork. And he gave them permission, and so they entered the swine. So I guess if my math is correct, I mean 6,000 demons and 2,000 pigs, I guess that's three apiece. Well, it scared the devil out of the pigs. Or something like that. And they got so scared, they started squealing and running down the steep embankment into the sea, and all 2,000 were drowned in the sea. That must have been quite a sight. Well, it must have been quite a sound as well. You understand, I don't know much about pigs. But I've begun to understand what they mean when they talk about squealing like a pig. We have a place out in the country. We call it a farm. That's not what the neighbor calls it. We have a lake. Not what the neighbor calls it. In Texas, they'd call it a tank, you know, or maybe dignified as pond. But at any rate, we have this place, and the neighbor, who lives a quarter of a mile away, but the neighbor, Mr. Deschler, used to be, he'd have pigs. Now, I don't know what he'd do to one of those pigs, but the pig didn't like it. And the pig would begin to scream. You know what I mean? Just squeal like crazy. Now, that's a quarter of a mile away. It sounded to me like the pig was in front of the first pew here. I mean, I think you could hear Deschler's pigs in the next county. Can you imagine what 2,000 squealing pigs would sound like? I mean, the text says that the folks close by took word into town. I think that's a bit redundant, don't you? I don't think they had to take the word into town. I think the word took itself to town. And everybody wanted to know what was going on, and so they came up over the rise of the hill and next to the water's edge, and there they found them. There's the demoniac sitting there, clothed and in his right mind. I mean, all dressed up for Sunday school. And standing next to him, the healer, Jesus. Can you imagine? Can you imagine the excitement? Can you imagine the thrill to think that this man who had been such a problem to himself and to the community, that this man was now whole, he was healed, he was well. Think of the thrill. Well, they weren't thrilled. I mean, you'd think that they would present Jesus with the key to the city. No, they presented him a bus ticket out of town. And you can't help but ask, why would they ask the healer to leave? I mean, after the wonderful thing he's done. I know some may say, well, maybe they said, you know, we've always answered our social problems this way. That's too cheap an answer. I don't think that will do. Maybe they thought it wasn't permanent. Yeah, he looks real good now, all dressed up for Sunday school, but wait until you hear him in the middle of the night. They didn't maybe trust the healing? No, I don't think that's the reason either. Do you know why they ask him to leave town? Because, you see, they owned the pigs. That's right. They owned the pigs. I mean, the text will confirm it. It says, I mean, the herdsmen didn't own the pigs. They were hired to tend them. The people who owned the pigs lived in town, and the text says rather clearly that when they heard what had happened to the demoniac and to the pigs, they came over the rise of the hill, and they said, would you please depart from our neighborhood? It has kind of a familiar ring to it, doesn't it? They owned the pigs. Have you ever stopped to think that any time anybody ever gets healed, somebody loses some pigs? Any time any group of people are set free from oppression, somebody else loses privilege. Any time you hear about anybody who is asked to leave town, take a good look around to see who owns title to the pigs. It'll explain a great deal. Anytime anybody is set free from their demons, somebody loses pigs. You really can't understand South Africa without understanding the ownership of pigs. You see? It's amazing how compassionate Americans can be about the dispossessed all over the world as long as somebody else is owning the pigs. But if it happens that we have part interest, part ownership in the pigs in question. Well, that's a different matter. I mean, don't let freedom get out of control, you know. I remember a number of years ago, I was preaching in a little town, Jackson, Missouri, right located in south, it's in the southeast part of Missouri, right at the edge of the Mississippi River. And I was preaching there on a Sunday, and I was going to stay through Monday, and somebody said, you know, there's a wonderful state park here right outside Jackson. You really ought to see it. You will enjoy it, and it is lovely. I said, okay. So they lent me a car on Monday morning, and I took a drive out to the state park. And, the name of the park was Trail of Tears State Park, but that didn't mean much to me, frankly. And so I went, and I did enjoy it in the sense of, oh, it was lovely. But it just happened that I came across a grave plot. And there was a marker there in that lovely park. And it said, here lies Princess Otaka, daughter of Chief Bushyhead, one of several hundred Cherokee Indians who died in the ice crossing of the Mississippi River in the hard winter of 1838. What's going on? I didn't know anything about any ice crossing. I didn't know anything about the Cherokees. I didn't know anything about the Trail of Tears. What's going on? Well, I decided maybe I ought to do a little homework. Maybe there was something in school they didn't teach me when I took American history. So I did. I did some research. I had a couple of friends who knew something about the subject. So I did a little. I didn't know. I just did. I didn't know, for example, that the Cherokee Nation was the incredible nation that it was in the southeastern part of the United States. I didn't know their head of state was respected as one of the wonderful heads of state in all the world. He went all around the world visiting with other heads of state. Did you know that? Their court of law, their language system, I didn't know all those things. And I didn't know that when the white folks began to want the land that they had in Georgia and Carolinas and around that part of the country, I didn't know that the head of state of the Cherokee Nation wrote to the president, imploring the president to defend their rights. Do you know that the letter, which is still existing, written in English as a second language, has far greater command of the English language than the return letter by the President of the United States? Do you know that they took their case to the Supreme Court and won, only to have it nullified by President Andrew Jackson, who said, "Let them enforce it." And so they were led across the country. 25% of them died on the way to the region called Oklahoma. Genocide. I didn't even know. And as I got to thinking about that, I said, you know, the Cherokees, Oklahoma, the Cherokees. I know the Cherokees. I mean, I was raised in South Central Kansas. The folks, my brother and I, often would travel through Oklahoma toward Texas. I'd been through Cherokee country. I can remember, this is before the interstates, which separate you from everything, you know. But I can remember driving along the road, looking out the window, and seeing Cherokees sitting there, mute, motionless. They wouldn't even flinch as the car went by, staring with a vacant stare of lost dreams, smashed hopes, and broken promises. Now, with the highest record or rate of alcoholism of any group in the country, there they were, sitting there staring blankly ahead. I knew the Cherokees. And I got to thinking, now wait. Did we chain up the Cherokees on the reservation because they had a demon? Or did they get a demon because we chained them up on the reservation? I don't know, but I do know this. When Jesus comes to your town, it is unlikely that he will be welcomed by the head of the Chamber of Commerce. It is more likely that he'll be greeted by the crazies in town. They always seem to know his name. The man said to Jesus, "Let me go with you." And Jesus said, "No, don't come with me." He said, "Stay, go back to your friends." Friends? Friends? What friends? He didn't have any friends. He was utterly alone. The only people he was close to were the dead people in the cemetery. Friends? Except, you see, in the redeeming power of Christ, it isn't just the crazies who can get healed. There's a new community that can be forged in town because Jesus has come not only to cure the demoniac, but to cure the community of its demons as well. Go back to your friends. Jesus didn't just come to save lone individuals, but came to transform history into the reign of God, because there are demons everywhere in the graveyard and in the town. No, go back to your friends. And there the demoniac stands wondering what to do. And I think as I look at him, I say, I can resonate with him. I know what it's like to have demons and to want the demons to go away, to be whole. And then somebody whispers in my ear, "Hey, I think you've made the wrong connection. Maybe you're not there. Maybe you're in town." Oh, And you still have demons. Yes, we do. Well, whatever identification, all I know is what Jesus said to that man that day, Jesus says to every one of us this very moment. To whatever degree you have been set free from the demons of your life, to whatever degree as a demoniac or as a member of the oppressive community, to whatever degree you've been set free from the demons of your lives, in whatever way Jesus has set you free for life, I say in God's name, for heaven's sakes, go, tell the world what the Lord has done.